I'm Amy Hall. I'm here with Greg Kokel, and you're listening to Stand to Reason's hashtag STRAsk podcast. And this is the podcast where we get your questions from Twitter. You send those in with the hashtag STRAsk, and then we answer them. We answer two or three of them.
We respond to them.
We respond to them.
We don't always answer.
And that's how it goes. So we're dependent on your questions. So thank you for sending those in. We really appreciate that. All right, let's start with a question. This one actually follows somewhat from the one we answered in the last podcast, the last question. This comes from PredorDox. God exists in eternity past before creation and sin. So wouldn't the trait of justice have to be an emergent property of his nature rather than essential? Without sin, evil, or some type of imbalance, it seems that justice would be a foreign concept.
Well, that's a very interesting question, and I actually have thought about this a little bit. And I think of it relative to an argument that I've actually made that I think has merit, but I've wondered myself, and that is about God's love and the Trinity. And if there's a Unitarian God, then there is no love because love is something that's shared. There could be kind of, in a certain sense, the quality of love, I guess, and somewhat in the abstract, but not active love unless there's someone to share it with, okay? And for love to be actualized in that sense, then God would have to create for something to love. That makes him his quality of love contingent on his creation. But in the Trinity, you don't have that problem. This is an argument that William Lane Craig makes. And so it must be good. Actually, I don't agree with everything Bill says, but in any event, I think there's merit to that. But I have wondered about it for the same reason, because there are other qualities that are part of essential parts of God's nature that, like justice, that seem to be the kinds of things that can't be actual. Or at least operational prior to creation. So how does that work, you know? And I'm not sure. It might be if God is atemporal, completely atemporal, so that's not my view. But if God is completely atemporal, then sin and corruption and therefore the need for justice are always eternally present before God. Okay, because the world is he views the way C.S. Lewis characterizes it in Mere Christianity. He views history like a book, and so you can go back and forth and whatever the whole thing all at once. And that, by the way, is ontological. In other words, that is the way it is for God. It isn't just that his omniscience gives him access to the past and the present. There is no past and present to God. And so in that case, I think it would avoid the problem because since the sin is always there in the book, then the justice is always manifest. Okay. However, I think that would also take away the argument for the Trinity and God's love, because a Unitarian God would be loving in the same way, okay, if he was atemporal. So anyway, there's just a thought, something to chew on, just came to mind. One could also say that what justice is, and we've talked about this in the past, and not, I don't really know how, you know, really fancy schmancy theologians work this out. But it does occur to me that what justice is really an expression of goodness. Okay, and when there's a violation, and goodness is a native quality that God has, even it's unrelated to other created things. It is fully his own. And so what you could say that maybe justice isn't the kind of quality that is eternal, but becomes an expression of his eternal quality of goodness when justice is required. I'm not sure. I don't want to make that statement because I don't know what liabilities are there. I'm just toying with options right now. But I don't have a whole lot to say about that. And it may be, look at it, it just may be that justice is an eternal quality of God that gets manifest and expressed when the circumstances require it. Love seems to be, at least arguably, in a separate category, because love is relational by nature. And in other words, love is not something that just sits there ready to happen. A person is not in love when there's nobody to love. But when there's someone to love, then love becomes real. A person can be just even though there's nothing to punish. But I don't think that that's the case with love. Love seems to be the kind of thing that requires relational interaction to be. And this is why the Trinity is so important, because God is love. And if love is relational, there must be a relation where the love is manifest and active. And that's the Trinity, or so the argument goes.
Yeah, I have some thoughts on this. I think those are good thoughts, Greg.
It's nice of you, Amy. Thank you for
justice.
Throw me a bone. Well, I fully acknowledge, I think this is something you're going to be much better on than I am.
I have thought about this. So I'll give you my thoughts. You can tell me what you think. First of all, I think justice is treating people the way they deserve. So therefore, the persons of the Trinity were just towards the other persons of the Trinity.
Oh, interesting.
They did treat them the way they deserve. The fact that there weren't people who required his wrath because they deserved it doesn't mean that he wasn't just among the persons of the Trinity.
Well, that's so interesting.
And so as far as
love— I like that, Amy. I like that. It's good. Okay, going. Good.
Because God's character, and I think, Greg, you touched on this, God's character as perfect love. Now, think about what Paul says about the law. Paul says those who do everything in the law are showing love. The law is the expression of love, because love is the way you treat other people. And Greg, you're talking about it being relational. So God's character as perfect love expresses itself in different ways in different situations. So it expresses itself as justice rewarding. It expresses itself as justice in wrath. It expresses itself in different ways, in ways that it wasn't expressing itself when it was just, you know, the Trinity. But that doesn't mean his character was any different. It's just that it didn't have the things to respond to that would express itself in different mm-hmm. ways.
Right.
So I think God's character has not changed. It's not that he wasn't just before. It's that that aspect of his loving character had nothing against which to bring out a certain expression.
Well, it's like saying, given the definition, justice is treating those as they deserve. His justice was being expressed there, but his wrath was not being expressed because the members of the Trinity didn't deserve that.
Right.
You know? So wrath is an expression of justice. So I would say, so justice would be a feature of the character of God, but wrath is not part of his character. It is a response of his justice.
Right, which I would say his character is one thing too. I think that all the different words that we give to it are our way of trying to understand the different aspects of his one character. Because it's not like he's divided up into different characteristics
Correct.
That
yeah.
are added in.
God is not made of parts called love and justice, etc. Right.
So his character is whole. It's one. It's just that the expressions of it so that we can see it. I mean, God, obviously, the persons of the Trinity know the entire character at once. We don't. We only learn that as he expresses it.
Right.
And so this is one reason why I think, and we touched on this in the last episode, that we, as God expresses his justice in wrath, we learn more about God. As he expresses his love and grace, we learn more about God. So we, as human beings, learn more about his foundational character as he expresses it, as he meets up with different situations. Whereas the the persons of the Trinity are not learning their character through the expression.
Right.
They know it because that's who they are. And so the distinction I want to make here is that an expression is not a creation of a new quality.
Uh-huh.
It's merely another expression of the qualities that he already has in different situations. Does that make sense, Greg?
Yeah, it does. And I like the way you emphasized, clarified that God is a whole being. He's not a bunch of things stuck together. And by the way, that's true of us as well. We can conceptualize the difference between our mind and our will and our emotions and these different capacities of the soul, but the soul is not made of a bunch of parts kind of spiritually glued together, and that's the whole. We are a unified self that has these different kinds of capacities that we can distinguish and talk about individually, but at the same time, that isn't to suggest that our souls are what's the word I'm looking, like a mosaic like that, it's not, we're whole beings just like God is, with qualities and characteristics. Whole souls.
Whole souls. Yeah, it's an interesting way to look at who we are. It kind of helps you to understand how developing your soul affects all different areas. It's not that if you're working on patience, you're just affecting that one little thing. You're changing your soul, which expresses itself in all sorts of different ways in different situations. All right, let's go on to a question from Sarah, who wants help responding to an atheist question. And the question is, why do you believe in God's promises if you cannot prove that he fulfills them in a tangible way? Why do you have faith if you cannot prove in a tangible way that it leads to anything?
Well, I'm not sure what that person means when they say prove in a tangible way. I mean, that's an ambiguity right away. All right. And these sound like fudge words for me, because the minute you try to, well, both the word prove and tangible are ambiguous. And once you try to give an answer, it's going to be very easy for the person to say, that's not proof or that's not tangible. Okay. So I don't even entirely know what that means. But let's just talk about human relationships in general and confidence in promises. With any individual who has made a promise, all right, there are two ways that we generally feel confident that the promise is one they'll keep. And that is through our personal experience. Children may learn that their parents are good for their word. Why? Because they've experienced it time and time again. Now, that might be an example of tangible human relationships, and an atheist might say, well, that doesn't count because that's tangible human. Okay, well, wait a minute. I'm just arguing a principle here. We know we have experience with individuals who have kept their word in the past, and this gives us confidence they will keep their word in the future. All right, so there's one way of looking at it. Another way is that let's just say a promise is made to you by someone you have never met before that instant. Yet you fully trust the promise. Why would you do that? Well, we do that all the time with doctors and all kinds of other people who are skilled in their profession. In other words, we have reason to believe, based on the nature of that individual's circumstance or that individual's life or that individual's reputation, that they are trustworthy, and therefore we trust them. Now, both of those apply to God, it seems to me. Sometimes, and Amy, I'll start where you did. I don't know if it was this broadcast or the last one we did together, but we started at the cross.
Yeah,
so here we
one.
Have. I'm beating you to it here, Amy. Okay,
you are.
We started at the cross. God made promises in Scripture prior to the time of Christ. We know this from Dead Sea Scrolls, Isaiah 53, that there would be one who would suffer for our punishment and on our behalf. And then that happened. So God kept that promise, and it was a big one. And the reason he kept it is because he's good and he cares for us and he loves us. And so he's a good. Maybe somebody doesn't know all about that. Other people have. They say, look at here. I can bear testimony. But there are also other things that God has promised to do in our lives and scriptural promises. And we can see individual particulars throughout our relationship with God where promises are being fulfilled. Now, I have to emphasize this. I think both of those things apply. But the second one has to be qualified because, as C.S. Lewis puts it, God is not a machine. And so it isn't like we can just push these buttons and God's going to respond. He's an individual, takes a person who takes individual circumstances into account. And so sometimes we say, oh, I'm going to push that button and get that promise. And the vending machine doesn't produce what we just requested. And so God doesn't produce it, and we treat him like a vending machine, so we think it's broken. And this is where I think there are opportunities for Christians to have doubts, and which I fully understand. I think both of those categories are in play in our lives, but because we are in relationship with God, there's a friendship with God, and he is not just a buddy, but he is a father. That means there are other promises like disciplining us to make us like children. It seemed his good children seem to override other things, that other buttons we're pushing in Scripture that we ought to get something, okay? And so that needs to be taken into consideration. And just throw in another detail on this. I just read the first four chapters of the book of Acts, and what's very interesting is that there's a honeymoon experience after Pentecost. I use the phrase honeymoon experience because that's the way people used to describe your first few months or maybe year as a Christian during the Jesus movement. A whole bunch of adults become Christians, and everything's wonderful. God's answering all these prayers, and look at God's hand doing this and that. And there's all this miraculous stuff going on. And this was true even in my own life. I'd see this unbelievable stuff. Whoa. And I expected that to last just like that the rest of my life. Well, it didn't, because then the honeymoon's over and then you get down to real living and God gets down to real teaching. As Lewis talks about this in Screwtape Letters too. So, and by the way, that's what happened in the book of Acts. It wasn't like all of that jolly, jolly, whoa, signs and wonders being performed by the hands of the apostles and thousands coming to Christ, all the time. No, that was the honeymoon. And then things got tough. Then the persecution started. Then they get scattered. And most know the story there in the book of Acts. So that is meant to be a kind of a picture there with the church as it was with our individual Christian lives, where we experience the promises of God in very powerful, tangible ways, but then other promises kick in that have to do with long-term maturity and growth, and it ain't so fun anymore. And then we wonder, well, what happened to those promises anyway? So that's just not a postscript, but just a footnote to my comment about the two ways that we have confidence that someone will keep their promises.
Yeah, Greg, you did beat me to the cross. I think the question of in a tangible way, I agree with you, Greg. I'm not really sure what that means, but I do know that we can.
And that, by the way, that needs to be clarified. I want to underscore that. Do not let someone get away with that. This is a Columbo One. What do you mean by that? You got to get that. Prove and tangible. It's got to be on the table. Because a lot of times, pardon me for interrupting, Amy, but a lot of times what it does is betray a presupposition that is going to automatically inveigh against anything you say. And you want to get that out and flush it out and see what you're up against.
Yeah. So I think we can look at Scripture. We can look at not even just the cross. Go back to Abraham. Go back to all sorts of things. Joseph, he had the vision of the people bowing down before him, and, mm-hmm. and that promise was fulfilled. I mean, now what they might say is, well, how do I know the Bible is true? Well, okay, that's a different question. But if we're coming from a place where we think the Bible is true, then therefore we have reason to believe that his promises will be fulfilled. Well,
by
now you've got to talk.
Amy, that's why I threw in the thing about Isaiah 53, because we do know that Isaiah 53 existed before the time of Jesus, and we have the historically sound records of what happened to Jesus.
Perfect.
So that goes to the reliability, at least of one aspect of it.
And that would be a perfect place to go, very simple place to go to illustrate a promise that has been fulfilled in history. But we can also look at our own lives. We look at how God has worked in our lives, even when we thought he was failing us. You know, 10 years later, 15 years later, 20 years later, we look back and we see what God was doing. And as we see these things happening, it makes it a lot easier to trust as we go along. And so it's unclear to me, it's unclear to me if they're asking why you personally trust God or why they should trust God, mm-hmm. because my guess is that your reasons for trusting God aren't going to be enough for them because they don't believe God exists. So mm-hmm. ultimately, it's going to come back to that. But you can at least be clear about why you are trusting God and
right.
why you are trusting his promises, because we do have reasons to do that.
Yeah, Bill Craig makes the distinction between knowing and showing. We may have good reasons to know, but that may not be good enough reasons to show other people that our views are correct.
Mm-hmm.
J.P. Moreland, by the way, on the issue of answered prayer, he suggests that people pray very specifically, so specifically that you have something akin to specified complexity. That is, and this has happened in his own life. He prays this particular prayer has all these particular details in it, and then all of the prayer is answered to the letter. Okay, so when you have a lot of complexity in a prayer request that is specified in a very precise way, and then it gets answered. I'm not saying God's going to answer all your specified prayers, but I'm saying when it does get answered, this is a powerful evidence of intelligent design, which is where the concept is usually used. So I think that's a good recommendation. And many of us have examples like that. Here's something I prayed. Here's something I asked for. And this is not the kind of thing that some kind of chance thing was going to cause to happen. It's something that's beyond that. That's not the most reasonable explanation, chance. It was just a coincidence. Like one person said, well, all I know is that when I stop praying, the coincidences stop happening.
And of course, any discussion about this will lead to more foundational questions. Why do you believe the Bible? Why do you think God exists? You know, how do you know you're not just imagining these things? Well, our beliefs are built in a web. There are so many different things that build into our belief that God is trustworthy. And so a lot of things will come up. But I think, Greg, the simplest thing to do is what you said, Isaiah 53 and the cross. And that might be the perfect place to start right there. And this might be the perfect place for us to stop because we've gone over time already.
We have.
All right. Well, thank you, Greg. And thank you, everyone, for your questions. We always look forward to hearing from you on Twitter with the hashtag STRAsk. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.